you all for coming to this. I really care a lot about issues of mental illness and mental health and theological anthropology and systematic theology. It's a developing area of interest for me, so I'm going to share some of the main points today from some of the presentations I've given on this already, but this, I think, is signaling where I'd like to go with my research in future years. So my talk is titled, It Was Simply the End of What I Could Bear, Resetting Christian Theology on Mental Illness and Suicide. And that quote comes from a very well-known writer and psychiatrist, Kay Redfield Jameson, who wrote a book on suicide called Night Falls Fast, and she's talking about her own bipolar and her dealing with suicidality recurrently throughout her life. So I'll come back to that quote. So I'd like to give a little bit of background that I think is going to, all of this is going to follow the handout I've given, and I have a few more things I'd like to say as well. So just a little bit of background on suicide, just to get a sense of the scope of it. Suicide currently claims 1 million people globally each year or so. In the general population of the U.S., it's the 10th leading cause of death. Its rates have risen by 24% over the past 15 years. It is now the second leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 34. It went from being the third leading cause of death for teenagers to the second pretty recently. So it's second only to accidental death, including car accidents now, but it's more common now than homicide. Although older white men have been especially statistically at risk of suicide, its rates have risen by 64% for children in the past decade, especially black youth. This is something that the papers are tracking. People don't understand it that well. And Native American and Alaskan youth consistently have a very high rate as well. Queer youth are 5 times more likely to have attempted suicide than straight youth, and 40% of trans people have reported a suicide attempt typically before the age of 25. And if you are curious where I'm getting these stats, you can contact me and I will give you all the sources. The sources matter on these things because different sources have different stats. So the mainstream psychiatric community, I use that very loosely because there is a lot of disagreement when you really look at it, but the figure I hear over and over again is that in addition to acute psychological stress, mental illness, often, though not exclusively depression, is involved in at least 90% of suicides. That's something that psychologists, psychiatrists, and sociologists really debate about a lot, that 90% figure. It's hard to know what exactly is going on. We don't know in every case. Some of these judgments are made posthumously or postmortemly. So anyway, everything I'm saying, I'm aware that it's under contestation, basically. So major depression, if you look at the current Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders that came out in 2013, entails that a majority of the following symptoms, in addition to depression or loss of pleasure, exist for a person for more than 2 weeks. Weight fluctuation, sleep interruption, motor interruption, fatigue, feelings of worthlessness or excessive guilt, and inability to concentrate, and or recurrent suicidality. However, the few Christian theologians who have ethically considered suicide in the 20th century, apart from physician-assisted death, which normally is what gets a lot of attention, have often ignored or even explicitly dismissed the potential role of mental illness in suicide. I've read an article here or there by a theologian treating suicide in an offhand way, saying, well, you know, suicidal people aren't mentally ill. And I'm not totally sure what's going on with that. I think what they're trying to do is emphasize that suicidal people are not generally psychotic, which is true, but that's not that helpful because psychosis isn't even associated with depression. So I think people are trying to emphasize that suicide is a particular choice made by a person who actually doesn't have a break with reality the way that we think of with psychosis. I think that's actually what the distinction is. So that's just a little bit of background on that. I was really interested in a story that I came across in December, like 3 months ago. And on December 4th of 2018, this 18-year-old in the Midwest, Mason Hulleberger, died by suicide. the priest who presided over his funeral mass, Father Donald LaCuesta, gave a funeral homily that Mason's family found so offensive that while he was giving it, Mason's father got up in the middle and put his hand on the lectern and said, "Father, please stop."
Wow.
So I'm, you know, given my interest, I'm really interested in stories like that. So this event was very interesting to me. And then they didn't want to invite him to the burial at the in the cemetery afterwards. And then the Archdiocese of Detroit, where this was, apologized and removed him from saying funeral masses and wants him to get spiritual counseling, spiritual direction and counseling, basically. Okay, so I was obviously very curious what was in this homily. I found it, and it's a few pages long. I just included one snippet on your handout, and I wanted to just read that one snippet. So this is one. It's representative of the general points he's making. So LaCuesta says, quote, "If we Christians are right in believing that salvation belongs to Jesus Christ, that it does not come from us, and that our hand cannot stop what God allows for us, then yes, there is hope in eternity, even for those who take their own lives. Having said that, I think that we must not call what is bad good, what is wrong right. Because we are Christians, we must say that we must say what we know is the truth, that taking your own life is against God, who made us, and against everyone who loves us. Our lives are not our own. They are not ours to do with as we please. God gave us life, and we're to be good stewards of that gift for as long as God permits." So this quote is representative of this homily from December in that it emphasizes divine mercy, but also says suicide is wrong. Those are the two themes I see over and over again. This was very interesting to me. I'm so sorry for the pain that he caused that family and the loved ones of this teenager. I'm also very interested in the reception of the homily because I want to include a passage from the latest catechism of the Catholic Church from 1994. So I have that right below. So this is from the catechism. Quote, "Suicide contradicts the natural inclination of the human being to preserve and perpetuate his life. It is gravely contrary to the just love of self. It likewise offends love of neighbor because it unjustly breaks the ties of solidarity with family, nation, and other human societies to which we continue to have obligations. Suicide is contrary to love for the living God. Grave psychological disturbances, anguish, or grave fear of hardship, suffering, or torture can diminish the responsibility of the one committing suicide. We should not despair of the eternal salvation of persons who have taken their own lives. By ways known to him alone, God can provide the opportunity for salutary repentance. The Church prays for persons who have taken their own lives." So I'm aware of that passage from the research I do, and then when I went and looked at LaCuesta's homily, I saw a lot of the same ideas. But then what's interesting to me is the amount of outrage that the homily got. And so I think the narrative isn't that we have this demonic, rogue, aberrant priest torturing this family. I think that we have a failure of doctrine at a larger level. That's what I think is going on. I imagine LaCuesta was probably confused, actually, because I think he probably read the catechism and then tried to do a homily in keeping with that, and that's what's interesting to me. So I think that he's performing a faithful gloss of current Catholic doctrine, but that the doctrine needs development and to change in a few ways I'll suggest. So it is true, just for some context, that the Catholic Church has softened its position on suicide quite a bit. And you see that softening in the 1994 snippet that I just read. But it is, there's almost, you know, there's two millennia of a position of this is a sin, it's against God, it's against neighbor, it's against self. You see that in Augustine. Aquinas picks that up. Dante puts suicides in hell, people who die by suicide in hell, suicide decedents. In the medieval period, people who die by suicide, their bodies are dragged around, they're denied funeral rites. That changes in the 20th century with the Catholic Church. But I'm just saying we have a long time, like a long history of suicide stigma. So there is a softening of that, but it's still a lot to soften. So I think that the Catholic Church still has quite a bit of work to do to enter into people's experiences of suicidality and to destigmatize suicidal people without normalizing or romanticizing suicide. Such examination of the experiences of deeply suicidal people uncovers, I think, a searing pain that victimizes them in a singular manner and I think scrambles commonplace ways of conceiving of moral agency and sin. This is because I would argue that in many cases, the violent self-inflicted act here is not really voluntary in a straightforward sense. And I think that's something that's missing from conversations generally. I think it's something that people know, but I think in academic theological conversations that piece falls out more than it should. There's a lot of really good work now being done on suicide and mental illness. Clinical psychologist I like a lot, Thomas Joyner, who's written extensively about suicide. I use his work. I'm in a different discipline. I have disciplinary disagreements with him, but I think he's really helpful. So he has this three-part theory of suicide that he's developed over the past 10 years from just tons of studies. Again, there are questions about social context that he leaves to the side. He's like, what is happening to an individual, regardless of how they got there, when they're suicidal? That's kind of his question. And so he says there's three things that have to be there for someone to be suicidal. So I have them listed. First, they have to be, in some sense, habituated or accepting of physical violence or pain to themselves. And this is something that's underappreciated about people who are really serious about suicide, that they have to... Some people have a natural disposition for violence, but most people have to work up to it, actually. It's not natural to harm ourselves. So, for example, it's not uncommon for suicide decedents who have stab themselves to have superficial marks on themselves from before the fatal stabbing that medical examiners call hesitation wounds because that's so hard. That's how they distinguish suicide and homicide with stabbing. Furthermore, groups with a heightened suicide risk that otherwise seem to have little in common, like medical doctors, cyclists for the Tour de France, Shoah survivors, anorectic people. Maybe you can find a lot of commonalities between these groups, but one thing they have in common is a heightened tolerance for pain and violence. Second, suicidal people, according to Joyner, experience an intense degree of what he calls a perceived burdensomeness. They feel burdened and they feel like a burden. So suicide is attractive because suicidal people are suffering from a particular type of psychological pain, which burdens them and makes them feel like a burden, as I said. So a suicidologist in this generation before Joyner, the one who founded the American Association of Suicidology, Edwin Schneidman, develops this term psych ache for the psychological pain that he thinks suicidal people are in. And suicide then feels like an escape from that. Suicidal people enduring this type of pain have reached a point in which suicide seems to be the only option. People get really nervous when they hear that word only when they're talking to suicidal people. The word only is telling. And if other non-lethal choices convincingly bore the alluring promise of relief from this psych ache, then people would rather do those things. Schneidman captures the ambivalence that results from this well. So I have a quote from him. The prototypical suicidal state is one in which an individual cuts his throat and cries for help at the same time and is genuine on both sides of the act. And then another line from Jameson that I think gets at this is from her own experience. Quote, I had tried earlier to kill myself and nearly died in the attempt, but did not consider it either a selfish or not selfish thing to have done. It was simply the end of what I could bear, the last afternoon of having to imagine waking up the next morning only to start all over again with a thick mind and black imaginings. It was the final outcome of a bad disease, a disease it seemed to me that I would never get the better of. People experience what Joyner awkwardly calls a low sense of belongingness. I probably would have worded it differently. But in this case, a suicidal person feels that she does not really belong in the human community and that her life is not only worthless, but it's a drain on everyone else. I don't know, perhaps some of you have talked to people in that state. This is a really common idea that comes up. Another quote from Jameson, I think, illustrates this well. She says, she's someone who's married, has a lot of friends, is highly successful as a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. I just want to be clear about that, where she's coming from. So this is something she's talking about that's happening inside of her to some extent. I knew my life to be a shambles, and I believed incontestably that my family, friends, and patients would be better off without me. She says when she gets in that state, there's nothing outside of her that can convince her otherwise. I know that sometimes social contexts are oppressing people and telling people that they're worthless, and that's also a huge piece of this. But it is also true that sometimes someone has a lot of privilege and resource and then still can't connect with people in a healthy way. So I want space to talk about all these different ranges of experiences here. So the notion that one's death will benefit others is surprisingly common in suicidal people's narratives and suicide notes. Many people who have died by suicide go out of their way beforehand to make the impact of their death seem less gruesome for loved ones, and that these same people who leave suicide notes often include expressions of love for family and friends, along with instructions about bills and pets. It's not uncommon for somebody to enact a plan to end their own life and to then call 911, not to save them necessarily, but so that they come first before their loved ones come to them. So there's a lot, given the myth that suicidal people are very selfish, there's a lot of instances of people trying to go out of their way to care for people to try and lessen the impact. So sometimes it seems like there is a carelessness in certain cases, and people like Joyner, and I think there's a lot of good evidence for this, would argue, though, that there's a type of cognitive constriction that can come over people when they're ready, when they have made a decision and they're going to enact it to end their own life, that's the only thing that they can think about. They're not thinking about anyone else because the pain is that big. So there are some times where it seems like selfishness, but I think a psychological state is a better way to, a better lens for thinking about what's going on there. And then the other thing I would add into, just for my own sort of theological thinking about this, is that I think when we think about something like the Catholic Church, there also has to be space to think about people who have already died by suicide. I think we don't know what to do with that. I say this as a Catholic theologian thinking about the Catholic Church. I think that this neglect right now, at least, occurs for a couple different reasons. I think there's still a lot of stigma around suicide. I think people are very freaked out about it and don't know what to do about it. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that suicide loss survivors will hide the reason that a loved one died because they don't want to be ostracized. And then I think also, just at this deeper level too, I think there's nothing that can be done for people who have already died. And so it's just hard to know. I think people don't know what to do with that. And so it just sort of seems like an end. And so so I want to destigmatize people who are suicidal and dealing with that. And I want a space to grieve and think about and remember rightly people who are already gone. One theologian that I think is really helpful for this, that maybe some of you are familiar with, would be Johann Baptist Metz, the German theologian, who was Karl Rahner's student, really important for Catholic political theology, still living, he's still kicking. So he didn't write about mental illness, but I think some of his ideas can be adapted well for some of the things that I want to do. So he is very interested in theology as being a protest against suffering, as a lament to God that remains open. So for those of you who may not be that familiar with him, he gained this sort of theological orientation after a harrowing experience in the German military in 1945 at the age of 16. He was returning solo after a night's errand to find all of his military comrades, who were also teenagers, killed by a bomber and tank attack. And he talks about how this experience drew from him what he calls a wordless cry, that signaled for him an anguish that has been like very impactful for his theology going forward. So in the wake of this event, he consistently maintains that theology must remain an exercise in theodicy, in the sense of speaking to God in the face of suffering. Not trying to come up with an explanation for suffering, which is sometimes how the word theodicy is used, but just saying, this suffering is happening, and I cry out to God. Rather than be solved, this question of suffering must be allowed to hang in the air, unanswered and troubling. Demanding of God a loving response that, as a matter of Christian hope, will be made known eschatologically. Like, we're not going to come up with explanations for what happened. So I think there's a tension in what Metz is doing. I think he's saying that the living have to take up practices of responsibility and solidarity with the dead, and force ourselves not to forget them, to remember them rightly, and then hoping also that they're not really lost in the long and to God. They're not really, really lost. Their loss to us is real. Their pain is real, but in some sense, we hope that they are with God. On the other hand, Metz reflects the dead, after all, also belong equally to the universal community of all humans in solidarity with each other. So they are lost to us, but if they are still here in some sense, we have to really hold on to that. Despite the chasm between the living and the dead are still humans with God-given dignity, and they're at risk of being excluded from the human community. And his point in saying this is that then we should really be active in this life about being attentive to people who are suffering. Not saying, oh, we'll just leave it up to God, but actually, if they're not lost to God, what does that say about what we have to do for each other now? Though Metz himself, as I said, doesn't explicitly address mental illness or suicide, I think you can see why I would find him a really fruitful connection here on this topic. As I said, the stigma is still really steep around suicide. I think people do want to put suicide decedents away because it's so painful. But whatever their faults in life as individuals, because we all have them, suicide decedents, I think by virtue of their suffering and marginalization, fit well within Metz's category of the dead and the vanquished, the victims of history. And I think also suicide decedents are at risk of being redefined solely by their death. I think anyone who's lost someone to suicide understands this very well. A Catholic priest I really like who writes about this, Ronald Rollheiser, who just came out with a book about this, says, and I have that quote on the handout, "Suicide not only takes our loved ones away from us, but it also takes away our true memory of them. The gift that they brought into our lives is now no longer celebrated. We never again speak with pride about their lives. Their pictures come off the wall. Photos of them get buried deep inside drawers that we never open again. Their names are less and less mentioned in conversation, and the manner of their death we rarely speak. Suicide takes our loved ones away from us in more ways than we sometimes admit. It functions like the antithesis of a canonization." So I think I was always really struck by that phrase, the antithesis of a canonization, which is why I think about the communion of saints here and wanting to really stake out a claim that suicide decedents, as a matter of Christian hope, are in the communion of saints. I don't think that should be a revolutionary idea. I have not come across that idea anywhere. So I guess I'll do it. I think because the risk of morbid distortion is so high here, it is all the more important that Catholics recognize the responsibility of the living not only to understand the torment of suicide decedents, but also to remember them rightly, to reclaim their narratives as humans with lives that cannot be encapsulated by their deaths, and to hold them within the prayerful, loving bounds of the human community. And then I'll end here. The Catholic Church not only has the option to encourage remembrance of those dead by suicide, but the responsibility. Specifically, the living have the task of recognizing the profound misery of those who've died by suicide, but also their joys, interests, and personality traits, their very humanity. And I think this is what Mason's parents wanted from Father Don LaCuesta. I think that's what he couldn't give them, and I think that's what the doctrine doesn't really have, but I think it's what the people want. So I'll end there, and thank you for listening to me.
Questions or comments?
Thank you, Elizabeth. This is really deeply thought-provoking. So one thought it raised for me is, and I, as you may know, I come from a perspective of Buddhist psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that was sort of screaming at me through this is the immediate community around the person who's decided to commit suicide and then actually does it. What I didn't hear yet, but I'm sure you've thought about it, is it's not just a matter of what we think about the person who committed suicide. They're bad, they didn't fulfill their human life responsibility, things like that. But I think the primary thing going on about the feeling the urge to forget them, take their picture off the wall, not talk about them, feel embarrassed, have to say what happened to them, is our own sense of having failed them. Yeah. And we don't know how to hold our own sense of failure around someone who's committed suicide. Yeah. And that is a deep psychological issue that would need to be addressed in order to be willing to view them a different way in the ways that you're theologically working out, and that there would need to draw on some, in terms of Catholic theology, a theological principle that would also speak to the psychological condition of those who feel guilt around the person who committed suicide.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I think that's a really profound comment. I don't think I had thought about it in terms of the failure that would be part of the grief of suicide loss survivors, but I think that's really true. And I'm going to think more about that. The thing I've thought about a lot is actually the profound anger that a lot of suicide loss survivors have to work through as part of their grief. And I think in some ways has unfortunately sometimes given rise to these myths that suicidal people are selfish or how could they, you know, so I think that's also part of the grief. But I think that is at a deeper level masking that sense of failure and just profound sadness and feeling powerless.
I'm just thinking about why we would be embarrassed to make known to somebody what they did.
Yeah.
So the embarrassment, I think, may often have something to do with our own sense of failure. And we don't want people to be aware of how we failed also. Yeah. That's another dimension. But that's a psychological issue that would need to be addressed, not only working out the theology around the other issues.
Yeah. And what's the other thought I had that your comment raises for me is this. So if you go and follow this story of the Hulleburgers, Mason Hulleburger, who died, something really interesting and I think very inspiring about his parents is that they wanted him to be spoken of with love, and they wanted his life to be celebrated. Like, they didn't want to be shamed about it. And I actually really applaud their strength there too, but I think they were being put into kind of a shamed position and then they refused it. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't know where this falls in the catechism, where the teaching of suicide falls in the catechism, or what its relationship is to the other aspects of taking life. Do you have any insight into, I mean, I recognize that what's happening is in your proposal that some of the teaching regarding suicide being contrary to the love from a living God and that sort of thing would be sort of taken away so that we're concentrating more on the life of the person as dignified. Does that have any ramifications either direction from or for other teachings that might be closely related or closer related?
To speak to the first question or the first issue you raised, in the catechism it's treated under thou shalt not murder.
Yeah.
But what other issues would you be thinking
about?
I
don't know. I'm just curious. It seems to me that it's a question. The question about suicide and the reason that the church might teach what it does seems to flow naturally from a question about the taking of life. If it applies in this direction, it applies to myself as well, or whatever, right? Even though those, obviously the circumstances are much different. So would there be a way in which shifting the line of thinking with regard to suicide might alter the way that we think about other takings of life.
Right. That's a really good, I understand.
It's an unfair question as well, I apologize.
Yeah, it's not unfair. It's a really good question. That, the concern you're voicing is why the teaching hasn't changed,
yeah.
I think. But I don't think that we would have to necessarily get into all of these other murky categories about taking life necessarily if we really understood suicide correctly. I want to retain a sense of the harm of suicide. It is a taking of a life. It is chaos and it is violence.
I don't really want to look past that and be like, it's cool. Like, that's not really the type of society that I want us to move towards. That's not really the type of theology I want. I'm not interested in telling people they can't kill themselves. I don't think that's the right way to approach it. But I think what would really help this conversation with the Catholic Church would be if suicide were understood not as a type of murder, but as like a succumbing to a disease. Or, I don't know, sometimes I think about, like, if you're carrying a piece of furniture that's too heavy, if you're helping someone move and you buckle, is it a sin to buckle? That's honestly how I think about suicide. Is it a sin to die of cancer? Again, analogies are limited, but I think that changing how we think about it from sin to tragedy would really help, and it wouldn't necessarily take away from the gravity of what we're talking about. I saw Mark and am I calling on people? I don't know who.
You are.
Okay. Yeah.
When I was teaching canon law, when I was being ordained, training coordinator, Jack Fagan, God rest him, who was the head of the tribunal for the Boston Exorcism, which for non-Catholic, he's the person in charge of the putting the asunder with God and joined together, you know, sort of giving an alms and things like that. And suicide came up, and of course that was before Benedict's. Pope Benedict was the person who put out the new catechism that you're quoting from. So we're talking about the 90s here, or maybe the 2000s. Somebody said, well, you know, in those days, you weren't allowed to bury suicides from the church. You were not allowed to give them a funeral mass. The priest could go to the graveside and say prayers, but you were not allowed to give them a requiem mass.
Yeah.
Fast forward, 3 years ago, one of our varsity swimmers here at BC hung himself. Mm-hmm. And Tony kind of said there would not be any funeral, there wouldn't be any memorial mass for him among the students. He was a very popular kid. And I talked to Tony about this. I said, why do you do this? And he said, it's not because we think this person is in danger of being damned. It's we don't want to have a ceremony in which his friends will say, wow, look how wonderful they're speaking about it. Maybe they don't want to sponsor any kind of copycat kind of thing. So what I think some people read is sort of the hard-ass Catholic Church, sort of like being hard on this, you know, really is being done for a different set of reasons. So I agree with everything you said about the church having to rethink through its position on suicide. But I think I wonder to the extent, you know, that people were not allowed to be buried in hallowed ground and their bodies were left in the Middle Ages, their bodies were left out at the crossroads, you know. I wonder to what extent, I mean, certainly some people thought they were in hell, but I wonder to what extent it was. It's also because the church didn't want to give other people the idea.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very fair thing to say. Suicide clusters are a real phenomenon. And people, psychologists, including Joyner, are trying to figure out exactly what is the nature of the clustering patterns. And for someone like Joyner, he would argue that if a popular teenager dies by suicide, it could send a message to his friends who feel a kinship with him that's a great way to deal with their problems, or that really is an exit that works if they feel connected with him. It is a real concern. And so we do sometimes have a history. If you look at the history of how suicide has been condemned, if the state does put on a really hard line against it, it can cut down on clusters. So I actually understand what you're saying. At the same time, psychiatrists and psychologists who are very well aware of this say, when somebody dies by suicide, there are good ways to talk about it versus bad. There's better and worse. I mean, so for example, I think one thing would be really sending the strong message very clearly that this is not a solution. And while we love this person and they have so many gifts, like, what tremendous pain they had to be in to do this, and making resources available. So I think some of it has to do with the messaging that vulnerable people are given about what happens when somebody dies by suicide. And I think there are good and bad ways to do it. I definitely don't think we should be covering it up, though. So that's my thinking on that.
I was also thinking about how we talk about people who die from alcoholism and drug overdose, that it's sort of a slower kind of suicide, and I wonder if there's, have you thought about that?
Yeah. Interestingly, I know I feel like a broken record, but I mean, the psychologist I like a lot, Thomas Joyner, actually does talk about those issues too. I actually also have a little list of resources on the back if anyone's just curious. I just wanted to say that. And that's something I think about a lot. I'm trying to think how to organize my thoughts around that. For people who are struggling with addictions and dealing with that stigma, that is a tremendous burden. I think for someone to flip over into being suicidal, I do think that there is a line that has to get crossed, and maybe the plan can be enacted slowly. But I do think there is a distinction between being depressed and dealing with an addiction and then being like, I'm gonna overdose, so I die from it. And I think, without minimizing anybody's pain, I want to be clear about that line, that it kind of depends on what somebody's intention actually is. So,
because sometimes it's accidental suicide, you know,
yeah.
It's that wasn't really their intention, but
right.
That's what ended up happening.
Right. Right. So, and sometimes, I mean, there is also this other category where someone may be overusing drugs or alcohol and may have that thought of like, well, if I, you know, and so I do think putting oneself in that type of position is a type of suicidal thought. But again, for me, the question hinges around their intentions to some extent. But I would include, well, if I died, whatever. As a type of suicidality, I think. But it's something that people are talking about.
You know, again, thank you, Elizabeth. The phrase suicide cluster, I hadn't heard of it, but I've had experience of it. I remember just a group of three young men. The first guy committed suicide, and at the funeral, the parents didn't want it mentioned.
Yeah.
They were in denial. And while one of the family members had told me what had happened, it was denial. Then there was a second one 6 weeks later, and it was pretty awful. But then, and a third. And then the third one, the family, I think, took control. And the father spoke, and he kind of spoke wonderfully about his son who had died, and again about his gifts, as you said. And but he said, you know, and he spoke to the young people present. He said, "No more of this. You know, let us support each other and walk with each other and whatever help we might need." It was an extraordinary, you know, kind of powerful, you know, reaction, I think, and maybe the way you were. Is that the sense you were going?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think everything can be. dealt with and mourned and ritualized in appropriate ways, but I don't want anything covered up. Actually, I think if somebody dies in this way, people need to know that that happened. But I like the attempt to hold that intention with a humanizing move to really remember the person who died, but then to also say that this is a very harmful thing, actually. And if you're in this type of pain, let's work on that. You know, that's where I would want us to go. And I think some parishes are going in that direction, too. So I think that some families have been well served, but I think it varies parish to parish. So.
I was going to just affirm that. My 25-year-old son died by suicide a year and a half ago. He's a BC grad. From all external views, you would think he was doing great. He was working in private equity in Wall Street. But his funeral mass had over 500 people at it. There were more young people at that mass than most people have probably seen in church in a really long time.
Yeah.
Many of them weren't Catholic, but many of whom were. And our priest who preached, and we did not want it hidden, and our son had actually left a journal he had kept for about a week trying to explain the pain he was in, and
yeah.
And that, and the message that the priest was able to give. I mean, everybody was rapt, and I cannot tell you how many of his friends have since reached out to me and told me they've gone to therapy, they've gone to see people, they've taken in hand struggles that they were having. And so I just see a lot of good, and if there's harm, it hasn't been made apparent to us about us not hiding how our son died and being clear about his struggles.
Yeah. I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you. But I am really appreciative of the work you're doing. I'm on the staff at the Paula Center in Boston and have a theology degree myself, but this is really important stuff.
Yeah. I'm glad the funeral mass was able to go this way and that his friends felt like they could look at themselves and think about what they needed and that they wanted to share that with you. Yeah, thank you.
I guess my question in a way builds on that. You were talking about Thomas Joyner's comments about being habituated to physical violence or pain. Is he equating the two? Because I see them as potentially very, very different.
No, he's not equating. I think he's trying to allow a spectrum to happen. So, for example, I'm trying to think of a couple good examples. I mean,
again, one of the things that drew me to coming today was the little write-up and talking about the just the psychic fatigue.
Yeah.
And I guess I see that a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what drew me. And so I guess I can appreciate the pain piece. I do some kind of a little bit not clear on the physical violence piece.
Sure. So, I mean, what I wouldn't call it an equation. I'd call it laying out a spectrum. So, for example, what are some of the groups I mentioned? Like cyclists for the Tour de France or anorectic people. There is a certain kind of grueling process that a body goes through that he talks about with both of those types of things, and those groups have a higher suicide risk. But also medical doctors who, I think there are other things going on with doctors related to burnout and stress, but I think also Joyner would argue the amount that they are around bodies that are broken and dealing with that and needing, because of the demands of the job, needing to be desensitized to violence done to bodies. I think he's saying that can be a type of habituation. But even, and I didn't mention this, but even somebody who maybe hasn't been around violence or any sort of grueling experience does have to go back and forth with themselves. Like, can I do it? Am I going to throw these pills up? Can I actually stab myself? Like, he's saying these are the types of questions somebody has to go through because it's not easy for most people to do. It takes energy. It's an extra step. And I think Joyner would argue that's why people who are in a really deep depression and then start to come out of it are actually at a key vulnerability point because they're getting some energy that they can then use to enact a plan that's hard. Some people are naturally more comfortable with violence, but I think he's saying for most of us, there's a process of habituation, even just mentally.
I mean, I guess I can see how the pain, like even you talked about the medical doctors being around, you know, people in difficult situations, and so you're just encountering so much suffering all the time that and unable to relieve it the way you want to.
Yeah.
I can see how it can put someone into a lot of psychic fatigue and pain.
And one final thought about that. I didn't say this, but he's making these points in the context of debunking myths about suicide. And so he says this in response to the myth that suicidal people are cowards and that they're not tough enough to handle life. He's basically saying actually it takes quite a bit of planning and fearlessness to do it. And I think he thinks that fearlessness is bad, like we should have some of our fears, but that's actually, it's not cowardice. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, going back to the catechism, and I'm going to find it here, it's going to take me a second to find it here, but when the catechism says that this act offends the love of neighbor because it unjustly breaks the ties of solidarity with family and nation and other human society to which we have continued obligations, it makes me wonder, what was the prior obligation? I think the family might also be caught in the same pain and suffering. So I'm saying the larger family, you know, if we want to say the parish family, the community family, the human family.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it needs to be the case that the person who is breaking the tie is the person who's committed suicide. And I wonder if that's a place where you're thinking doctrinally is in any kind of development, that the tie might have been broken prior.
Yeah.
In a way that fostered that pain.
Right. Thank you for that. I think that's a good question. I mean, I think I am going in that direction with trying to use meds to have us who are perhaps in the Catholic Church or thinking about these things and maybe not in the middle of it, what we can do. I want those types of questions to be on the table for Catholics and for anybody, really. What are we doing to create structures of support for people to destigmatize and then to find practices of reaching out to people? I think some parishes probably have some of that going, but I would like a much more robust, wider scale conversation about that to happen. And so I'm not sure what should happen on that, but I want that question on the table. The reason, there is this other piece to it too that I'm still trying to think through. But there's this other piece that I don't always know what to do with, which is that sometimes people, especially teenagers, but not only, of course, who are suicidal, make that known and get treatment, tell people about it. Their families love them. They have friends. And some of them still die by suicide. And so I also want a place to think about community responsibility and hold ourselves to a higher standard there. But I also want a place for people who were maybe around the person in question to say, I did everything and it's still didn't work, right? Like, so I think there's sometimes that disconnect and we don't know what to do with that too. So that's how I think about it. I want both of those pieces there. But yeah, thank you.
Taking those drugs and everything, it's the road to death. And yet the society seems to be approving of it, sort of with the marijuana.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have very different opinions about those drugs, just to be clear. People who are struggling with opioid addiction and probably depression too, and who are high suicide risk. I mean, I think there's a high level of pain there. There's, in many cases, some economic oppression that they're dealing with. I would like to look at that frame too. I actually, one of my good friends from college is a medical doctor, and I was talking to her recently, and I was like, explain the opioid, like, why did this happen? And one piece she was really interested in is the way that a couple older generations of doctors were really into prescribing opioids because it was an easy pain fix, even though it didn't address the underlying causes of the pain, whatever they were. And so I would also, there's just a lot of other questions I'd like to ask there. I mean, the marijuana thing, I'm a little less concerned about the usage of marijuana per se. What I am concerned about, honestly, with that is the way that it had been criminalized for so long and then used to put people, especially disproportionately people of color, in prisons, which is a context that greatly exacerbates mental illness and can create mental illness for people too. So that's, I don't know. When we think about drugs, I like to think about the social context in which they're occurring, if that makes sense.
But even the students who commented to me, they were in shock that marijuana is going to be sold at Mary Ann's, which is a bar they go to.
Oh, yeah.
So even kids are in shock. It's very strange, and one can only think that the pot industry itself brought this about. I mean, kids didn't particularly want it. The society didn't want it, but these behind the scenes, right, these people who make this
Sure. Whole
thing, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, I do think taking a step back, like, you know, I think in our country we have a problem with drug usage of all kinds, including prescription drugs, which is a leading cause of death, actually, more than illegal drugs. So, you know, I do think that that's a general problem. I think it's a way people like to deal with their pain, and we're encouraged to deal with our pain that way. So,
so should the society not discourage that behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go, I teach. I'm not going to go to my students and be like, smoke pot, kids. Like, I'm not going to do that. Like, that's not how, you know, I just wouldn't do that. But I do get concerned about stigmatizing and criminalizing something like smoking marijuana. Like, I just want to look, I don't know, that's not how I look at it, I guess. I'm worried about how it has been criminalized and what that's done. And that's just where my brain goes. I just have different energy. I'm not, like, really into smoking pot, and I'm not going to tell my students to do that, just to be clear.
It's just that we could make a positive effort to discourage it.
Sure. Yeah. So just, I mean, actually, I do have a point related to that. I mean, I think recreational drug use aside, I mean, I do think that people can turn to drug use as a way of you know, a palliative, a way of dealing with pain. And so I think it is good to message to our students, like, healthier ways of dealing with pain. I have concerns about our mental health services here. Okay. That's it. I absolutely do. I mean, students talk to me.
I think that was a collective amen.
I know. Students talk to me a lot about mental health issues they're having, and I do listen, and then I'm like, would you like to get some counseling? But then I say that knowing, like, oh my God, is that going to help you? Like, I actually have that thought too, so I don't know.
So do you think that other Christian bodies, or do you have examples of other Christian bodies who have dealt with suicide in a better way, in a more pastorally sensitive way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's some Episcopal writers that I think are doing a good job. I don't know, though. I still think some of it depends on the person in whatever community context they're in. I think there can be good Christian individuals and leaders who have dealt with it, and I have some of their writing. I think I put one of them on that.
Right. The Anglicans have a book called Other Usages.
Yeah.
And I think there's a rite of burial for people who have committed suicide.
Yeah.
Not in the Book of Common Prayer.
Right. And there are evangelical Christian writers who are starting to write about this. The theological baggage there is a little bit different than it is with Catholics, because I think some of the evangelical writers I've come, like Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life, his son died by suicide, and he's a few years ago, and he said he and his family have spoken really beautifully about that, but I think some of what they've talked about dealing with is just, I think, some vague prosperity gospel thing that they had to get over. Like, did we not pray hard enough? Why isn't God blessing us? And I don't hear that rhetoric quite as much in Catholic circles, but you can find it too. So I don't know. I think we're all struggling, basically, to figure it out.
Well, this goes to confirm, when I was being ordained, the guy who taught us ecclesiology said, if you have a ding-a-ling before ordination, after ordination, you have an ordained ding-a-ling. You know? So, I mean, it's very important who's doing the right thing. That's extremely important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Elizabeth, supposedly there's a shortage of psychiatrists in the Commonwealth of Mass. I mean, according to the news, they're saying if a person is in need of that type of help, very difficult for them to get it here.
Yeah.
So
that
that's
doesn't surprise me.
Could you say more about the complaints you heard from students about our health services? Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Some of you all may know better, but I've heard about really long wait lists. One of my students who was having some anxiety did get signed up to get in the queue for counseling, and they were like, in the meantime, just take these pills, but they hadn't talked to her at all, which I think is not great. So an over-medicalized approach to her. Pills may help her, but I think she needs to be talked to first. Feeling like they can't change counselors if it's not a good fit. Those are some of the things I've heard. I don't know what other people have dealt with or heard, but that's the little bit I'm getting so far. Anyone wants to say? I'm genuinely curious.
Yeah.
They can't take you weekly. Like, if you do get in, it's normally bi-weekly, I think, which is tough because it feels like a lot of time can, and a lot of things can happen in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be, like, so it's bi-weekly often, like, the beginning of semesters, and then that can often come to, like, every 3 weeks when it becomes more busy around midterms and finals, and then that can also, like, include sometimes, like, every month once you get to, like, breaks and things like that. It's just, like, not very
normal.
And
yeah.
Then, yeah, I agree with that. Like, if you don't feel like they assign you someone, and if you don't feel that they're the right fit, it's hard to find someone who is. And I think that fit is obviously something that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Part of the thing they also push, which, like, is understandable if they're not given the resources, because, like, I don't really have much against, like, UCS, all the counselors here, or the ones that I know about creating people with good experiences. But, like, because they're not getting the resources, a lot of the times, like, they'll have the approach of trying to encourage people that need more help and need to be seen weekly to go off campus.
Yeah.
But then I've also heard from, like, myself, a lot of other people have had issues with, like, actually getting the support with finding someone off campus, because that's, like, a huge step to take. And it's not just, like, walking into UCS.
Yeah.
It's having to find people with your insurance, and most people aren't from the state, which makes it harder to find that. So the actual, like, support about going off campus is lacking a lot.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, it's helpful.
I'm going to say that it's hearing you talk about the services available here at BC, that's not unusual. I'm not Catholic, but I've talked to parents of kids in high school who know of other kids who are having these thoughts. And it's very hard to find pediatric, psychiatric people who can deal with this. So I think it's a general lack in the public health approach. And I hear that more and more. The public health sector is beginning to look into this, but we just don't have the availability of providers. It just in general to who will be able to talk to that. So I think that the more that people like you speak of it, it may bubble up.
Yeah.
And so that it gets more attention in general.
I hope so. I don't know.
So it's not here.
Yeah.
It's not here that's the problem. It's in general. I think and also the idea that when I talked to many decades ago to the chaplain at McLean Hospital, who's a rabbi, and he said to me, I said something about being a little bit concerned about beginning to do some work there, and he told me that most of the people who have at least a touch of mental illness are outside these walls. So I think we're continuing to struggle with a general stigmas, stigmatizing of something that we probably all have to, arrange and particularly young people in high school. Undergraduate school. And there's not enough help, and I think it's not helpful to have those kids hear that, if they're having these thoughts, it's probably because there's something wrong with them. They're different from everybody else, whereas they're probably the same as most of us.
I completely agree. I mean, what I was going to say was, just going off of these comments, when I talk to my students, when they come to me, because I teach about these things in my classes, so it raises a lot for students, understand as human beings. But I still feel powerless because they are saying that I'm not seeing my counselor enough, I don't even like them that much, and I'm like, trying to help them get a handle on what they're saying, but I don't know what to do. I feel very limited by my role, and I feel limited by our general inadequacies as a society.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's just really stressful. And so the one thing I feel like I can do is, like, force people to talk about it. I'm talking about in my department at my university, that kind of thing. One of the sources, just it's directly related to this. One of the sources I have on the resource sheet is this book toward the bottom called The Collected Schizophrenia by Esme Weizhong Wang that just came out. It just got released like 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And she talks about having the onset of schizophrenia, actually schizoaffective disorder, while at Yale, and how horribly they treated her. This was 10 years ago or something. And basically because she was deemed a suicide risk, she wasn't like allowed to come back because universities are freaked out about liability. Mm-hmm. So like that's also this other layer too, but she's a beautiful writer. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I wanted to let people know about that because there is an essay about a university context there. So.
To continue on that, I just think, it's definitely not just a BC problem.
Yeah.
My daughter went to Penn, and I read the daily paper there every day online, and I mean, Penn has one of the highest suicide rates of any school in this country, and it's really just, it's overwhelming to figure out how to provide the right resources, and I think that we're still, medicine is still trying to figure out what its capabilities are, and I know there's been some efforts in some places to try and, in general society, not on university campuses, to co-locate mental health facilities with physical health facilities to try and bring down that stigma. But until you get insurance working the same way as it works for physical things, which is still not always ideal, but it's way better and more accepting, I think it's always going to be a problem. And I teach at Harvard Divinity School, and I frequently have the same issues, feeling like I don't know how to help my students, and especially since my son passed, I've been very open in saying that, if somebody wants to talk, I want to listen, but, the facilities at Harvard are not, it's not that easy to access, there's not enough, it's not convenient enough. Penn is just starting to co-locate counselors within each of the schools. They put it in Wharton undergrad last semester, and they're now expanding it to all of the other undergraduate schools, and they said that the response has been huge because students are willing to walk in when it's in a building they're already in, and I don't know how they're managing the schedules or the timing or whatever, but I think there's a whole lot of work in society in general as well, but I think the real problem is we don't know enough about mental health issues, and the demand is so overwhelming that it just seems like paralyzing to figure out how to handle it.
Yeah, I agree. I feel hopeful hearing even just that difference in vision created a different possibility for those students. It does make me think, like, what an uphill battle this is, because I think, what do universities want to spend money on?
Right.
mental health services, well, that's not very sexy. Right. That's not going to bring in the donations. So, that's not very hopeful on my part, I'm sorry, but these are some of the thoughts I'm thinking of, too. So.
Just as clarification, what we call mental illness is really physical in the sense that the brain is injured, So in other words, it's in a way, the net result is the person, the behavior or the thinking of the person is injured, but isn't the base a physical base for these illnesses?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, and something that people don't know how to talk about that well, myself included. I think my general answer would be yes to that. And just even if you take something like depression physically hurts, and there are all of these physical associations with mental illness that I don't think we give enough attention to. The tricky thing about mental illnesses and psychiatry and psychology in general is that, and if you look at the DSM, there's not like a brain scan you can do that you can look at and say, you're depressed, I see it in your brain scan. So what's happening is that doctors have to go with how patients describe what's happening to them. And so that that's still real, but it's a little bit different from getting a scan. And I don't know how to think about that difference, but it is physical, it's mental, it's spiritual, like it's everything. So, but I think that's an important question to think about.
it might take some of the stigma away. The stigma derives from the aberrant behavior or thinking of the person, but what's causing that? There's got to be some physical base, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And even if, to be clear, something physical or biological isn't necessarily genetic. Often there is a genetic component to mental illness, but I mean, trauma, if somebody is traumatized as a child, regardless of their genetic makeup, that can change their body, and it can change their brain, and it can make them ill in multiple senses too. So like, that's another component too. So like, what do we even mean by physical? So, yeah, thanks.
Going off of this, there's actually a study that was done about how someone, like how it affects someone if you talk about it as like a biological illness and more of like a problem with your thinking and like how it, or something about your past and your thinking. Mm-hmm. It was actually like surprisingly shown that talking about it as a biological illness can actually lead to more stigma, which is just creates a more confusing thing because it kind of led people to feel like because it was biological, it was more.
It's fatalistic. It's permanent. Yeah, that's who you are now, right?
Yeah. So like in a way, it helps because like people can see it as real, but it also can negatively affect that person and like seeing how it. I don't know. It can't really be changed. Easily.
Right. Yeah.
Not like a short direction.
No, you're right. I know what study you're talking about. Yeah.
But so much of mental illness is biologically based. I mean, and it, so sometimes it's a chemical imbalance. So it could actually have, you know, like medicine actually does help, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would, it's interesting because I would think the opposite. If I felt it was biological, then I would think like, well, it's not my fault.
Right.
And there is something chemically that I can take that can change the way my brain thinks, but that doesn't apply to all kind of mental illness.
Right. I totally get that. I think, bless you. I think the reason it might feel more stigmatizing to be like, oh, it's my biology, is that I think we as a society don't know what to do with illness. You know, I think that people are really, I mean, this is what we've been saying. I do think people are isolated if they get identified as ill.
Yeah.
And I think if we worked on that, I think then someone saying, well, something, you know, I want to work on my brain chemistry. It's not my fault, and I can have help, and I'll still have friends, and my context will take care of me. I think so. I look at the larger social context, too. Mm-hmm. I'm with you, though. I agree.
Please join me in thanking Elizabeth for her work.